This is Redux, a look back at the week that was in news from the WJCT News Department. I'm Vince Kong, your host, and this is episode 2. It's Friday, September 2nd, and Hurricane Hermine bearing down on Northeast Florida is just an exclamation point on an already hectic week. A week where we saw the ouster of two prominent Florida politicians who made national headlines for all the wrong reasons in the weeks leading up to Tuesday's Florida primaries. But just in case you forgot how last week ended, it ended with a controversial figure, at least here in Jacksonville, sitting behind bars. That figure is Pastor Ken Atkins. The controversial conservative was arrested and charged with child molestation relating to an incident in 2010. This is according to the Georgia Bureau of Investigations. WJCT reporter Ryan Bank has the story.
Atkins made a name for himself as a major opponent of efforts to expand Jacksonville's anti-discrimination law to include gay and transgender people. His protests have included cross-dressing in public and circulating sexually graphic images photoshopped with his opponents' faces. He's also worked as a political consultant for a slew of politicians, candidates, and pastors, including judicial candidate Gerald Wilkerson and Pastor Fred Newbill. Wilkerson disavowed Atkins after it came to light he paid him $9,000 to create his campaign website. Calls to Newbill went unreturned. Atkins' attorney, Kevin Glow, spoke to reporters shortly after his client turned himself in at the Glynn County Sheriff's Office.
We'd like to think that these charges or their timing isn't politically motivated. We certainly hope not. And we're not saying that they are, but given his past and his very vocal public positions on various issues, it's obviously a concern.
Atkins served on a panel of business leaders convened last year by Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry to weigh arguments for and against expanding the city's human rights ordinance. In an email to WJCT, Curry said if the allegations are true, he hopes Atkins is punished to the fullest extent of the law. He's expected to go before a judge regarding bond early next week. Ryan Bank, 89.9 WJCT News.
Here's an update. Atkins remains behind bars after being denied bond earlier this week, but he is expected to appear in Glynn County Magistrate Court shortly after this podcast airs. Switching gears. Jacksonville skateboarders are hoping to turn city-owned land into what they call DIY skate spots. Councilman Bill Gulliford met with 8 skateboarders and a real estate agent earlier this week in City Hall. They discussed plans that could transform Jacksonville into a skate mecca. WJCT reporter Lindsay Kilbride has the story.
Gulliford's cracking down after he says a skater's board took a chunk out of the marble exterior of City Hall.
Then I've had several people that have indicated they were almost hit by skateboards in the general vicinity of City Hall. And I thought, we got to protect our building, protect our people.
But after Tuesday's meeting, he's dialing back his bill. It used to prohibit skateboarding on sidewalks, but state law allows that, so he scratched that part. What's left is a prohibition on skating on city-owned property, including parks and fire stations, unless a sign says it's allowed, plus new fines for offenders. As part of the compromise, 9 skateboarders are in the room to work with him on setting up skate-friendly areas. Martin Ramos is the owner of Jacksonville's Kona Skate Park.
Let's have like 6, skate spots that are 5 or 6,000 square feet in this cool, skate trail that can connect them throughout, the entire area of downtown.
He says that way street skaters won't resort to handicap ramps in front of City Hall, and it could cast Jacksonville as more progressive.
That could be a turning point for Jacksonville if we could get everybody on board.
The boarders will be back to talk about city-owned parcels that could work for the first skate park. They say they can raise the money to fund the construction. Lindsay Kilbride, 89.9 WJCT News.
We now move on to 2 stories related to Tuesday's Florida primary elections. First up, WJCT's Ryan Bank reports on the monumental legal shakeup for the First Coast after 2-term state attorney Angela Corey loses to challenger Melissa Nelson.
Corey battled negative profiles in national press and allegations she was behind a scheme to close Democrats out of the primary. But just before the returns came in, she was unapologetic.
Angela Corey hasn't changed from the woman she was when she won 8 years ago, and I won't change 8 years from now. I will always do what I do best, which is care passionately about this community.
Corey says she'll keep working in law enforcement. In her victory speech, Melissa Nelson didn't waste time framing the challenge ahead of her.
We will be aggressive in seeking innovative solutions to these serious problems. We will implement meaningful reform so that we can all enjoy better outcomes. And I will work hard to restore trust in the criminal justice system.
Nelson took 64% of the vote. Corey held on to 26%, and Wes White got close to 10%. Ryan Bank, 89.9 WJCT News.
And now, former Democratic State Senator Al Lawson defeated 12-term District 5 Congresswoman Corrine Brown in the Democratic primary. But before polls closed, Brown told WJCT's Lindsay Kilbride that this was going to be one of her toughest races. And she was right.
Before polls closed Tuesday, Brown, a 12-term congresswoman, said this was one of her toughest races because her district was recently redrawn to include the Panhandle. Still, she was optimistic.
Maybe it's a long night, but I feel good.
Brown is facing 22 federal indictments on charges related to a fraudulent charity. She lost to Lawson by about 40-50%. Democrat LaShonda Holloway took about 13%. After her loss, Brown told our partner News for Jax she's proud of the work she's done and plans to continue it.
I will be involved. I mean, you know, I love serving people and helping people, so I'm good.
Lawson was in Tallahassee Tuesday night. His brother Kelvin Lawson said Congressional District 5 has gained a seasoned leader who will work bipartisanly.
To bring jobs to the district, help work on crime, work on issues that are important to the average person.
Brown says she will support Lawson as he faces Fleming Island Republican Glo Smith in November. Lindsay Kilbride, 89.9 WJCT News.
And now, a giant shopping, office, and residential development is coming to northern St. Johns County along I-95. In this week's business brief, WJCT business analyst John Berg tells news director Jessica Palumbo that that's one of the fastest growing areas in the state.
What can you tell us about this new development, John?
It's huge. It's being developed by Gate Development. It's called Durbin Park. Just a couple of numbers, 2.4 million square feet of retail, 2.8 million square feet of office space, and some apartments thrown in, a hotel or two. Just to give you an idea how big that is, St. John's Town Center has 1.4 million square feet of retail.
Hard to imagine.
So what makes this all really possible is the construction of 9B, which is a four-lane interstate-type road. It's part of the Beltway.
Part of I-295.
That's correct. That's how you get that mass of people who could possibly go to a site this big. 9B is also going to open up other older developments in St. Johns County that have been on the books but not built because they haven't had the road access until now. So 9B is really a pivot point for growth.
So what other projects are going to be made possible by the expansion of the Beltway?
Well, by far the biggest is this outer Beltway, which is going to come down through Clay County and swing east with a new bridge being built across the St. Johns, and that will hook into Interstate 95 in St. Johns County. I spoke with Brian Teeple. He's the CEO of Northeast Florida Regional Council about this growth in St. John's and Clay County. Here's what he said about that Western Beltway.
Just take a look at, for example, where certain things have located in Clay County in anticipation of that. You've got the new St. Vincent's Hospital. It's not located where it is by accident.
Teeple also said that the growth in Northeast Florida has picked up recently, and the projections are we're going to be seeing strong growth here.
And, you know, St. John's County is leading the way. They're growing at a 2.5% per year. They're the third, on a percentage basis, fastest growing county in the state.
Why is Northeast Florida so attractive to developers right now?
First off, it is in Florida, and the state is growing by 1,000 net residents per day, which is a pretty hard figure to get your head around, but it's true. Secondly, South Florida is pretty much built out. So if you're a developer and you're looking for land to build on, you're going to naturally start looking up here. The land's available, it's cheaper. And also in South Florida, there are concerns about the rising sea level. People are very worried about that down there. And also they're having drinking water shortages. So North Florida is looking very attractive.
WJCT business analyst John Burr spoke with Northeast Florida Regional Council CEO Brian Teeple. I'm WJCT News Director Jessica Palumbo.
For the final segment of this podcast, WJCT's quarterly program, Community Thread, started a conversation about the politics of arts education this month. Ryan Bank now looks at the debate over whether science, technology, engineering, and math should include the arts.
Jacksonville High School teacher Steve Ingram attended the live taping of Community Thread and asked the panel of experts this question.
How can the students' groups who are currently proactive get involved in the community discussion?
He says the debate about art education's relationship with harder subjects like science and math is one that's usually argued over by adult academics. But his Socratic Seminar Club is taking it up in their after-school meetings.
What are the advantages and disadvantages of the arts inclusion? Does anyone have a point of view?
He says the completely voluntary club is more than just a way for kids to kill time before their parents pick them up.
Asking them to question each other, we accentuate critical thinking, critical listening skills, and collaboration skills.
Ingram poses questions on a variety of controversial subjects. Nothing is off limits. So when he brings up the STEAM versus STEM question, he's a bit surprised by the passion on both sides.
Today, I did a science experiment with a group and we communicated. We were assigned a task and we had to figure out how to solve it, and then we did, together.
Okay, that works for you, right? Yeah. I know it's surprising to you, but not everybody in this world thinks like you. Not everybody in this world can learn things the way you do.
Some students, like senior Alex Tony, think public schools should spend shrinking budgets teaching more practical skills, while sophomore Asta Singha argues science and math aren't inherently more useful than art. But Tony wants to be a lawyer, a career that requires a lot of so-called soft skills, like communication, logic, and ethics. Sinha says his choice of study proves her point. Tony disagrees.
You can apply logical principles, which you learn in math and science, to laws, right?
Do you not think you can learn those things in art classes, in writing classes, in things like that? Do you not think you need, like, a strong creative background and a strong ability to write and to express things and communicate? And that's not always something you can learn in sciences.
In the end, the students don't exactly reach a consensus, but they do agree on one point. Artistic creativity can enhance science, just as a strong sense of math can help in the creation of art. Where that balance lies is still up for debate, and their teacher, Mr. Ingram, says he'll continue the conversation. Hopefully, he says, the students will also widen their after-school circle.
And we also seek out opportunities in community outreach to go and visit or to invite other schools to come here and bring in other communities of students to talk with us so that we expand the base.
Ingram, who has both an art history degree and law degree, says he hasn't come out firmly on one side of the debate or the other. But he says he's learned just as much as he's taught by bringing the question out of the political realm and into the classroom. Ryan Bank, 89.9 WJCT News.
You can find all of our audio and web stories at wjctnews.org. You can also stream this podcast as well as all of our on-air content on the WJCT app, which is available on iTunes and the Google Play Store. And of course, find us on your favorite podcast app and hit subscribe. If you've got the blues, you're in luck. Blues Horizon is aired on 89.9 FM or streamed on our WJCT app every Monday at 11 p.m. Host Andrew Reichman celebrates the best in classic and modern blues music, including artists such as John Lee Hooker, Robert Plant, and the self-proclaimed Queen of Blues herself, Dinah Washington. This week, Jacksonville musician David Hurt stopped by the studio to share stories of the road with the legendary Muddy Waters. David also brought his steel guitar and played us a pair of blues classics.
in my rhythm.
That concludes Redux from the WJCT News Department. Thank you for listening.